Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
So we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
oh, yeah. All right, everybody. That was Dar Williams singing with Pete Seeger, the great Solartopia song written by David Burns, who was also singing on it with his kids there. This is Harvey Sluggo Wasserman back with you for another hour in the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness World. We are a PRN, and we got two great guests, and we got a ton to talk about and an hour to do it in, so life is good. We have Howie Hawkins with us. Howie, where are you? You in upstate New York?
Yeah, I'm in Syracuse, New York.
And when is the last time you saw the sun?
Man, it's cloudy now. I'm trying to remember. It's been a while.
Right. I've been in Ohio. I'm back visiting my previous home here with my wife. And I have been here almost 3 weeks, and I have yet to see the sun, which is a great reminder as to why I moved to California. And Howie Hawkins, you are a very, very long-time activist, lifelong, and active with the Green Party, and you are now a candidate for president with the Green Party, right? You're running for the nomination of the Green Party for president. Is that right?
That's right.
So are you some kind of, do you love suffering? Are you some kind of masochist? Do you need psychiatric care? What's going on here?
Well, I was drafted. I wasn't looking to do this, but a lot of Greens around the country asked me to do it. And so, you know, it's a responsibility, I guess, to see what I can do. If they want me to do it, I'll do the best I can. And, you know, it's a lot of work. It's a bottomless pit. You can always make another phone call, make another trip, write another statement. But I'm enjoying it, and, you know, we're doing the best we can.
Now, you have a party convention. Is that where the nomination will be decided?
Yeah, in Detroit, Michigan, July 9 to 12 is the Green Party convention.
All right. Are there other people running for the nomination of the presidency for the Green
Party?
Yeah,
there's half a dozen. I think I got the strongest national campaign. I think there's another candidate that's doing a pretty good job. The others are pretty minimal.
Okay, well, I'm going to come back and ask you why, but first I'm going to talk to Joel Siegel. Joel Siegel, you are in Charlotte, North Carolina, and you are a great climate activist, among many other things. You worked for John Conyers for many years in the Congress. So what do you want to tell our listeners about what you're doing now?
Well, first of all, I'm honored to be on the same show with a courageous man running as the president of the Green Party. You can raise issues that corporate Democrats and centrists and they're not going to raise, like ending poverty, 100% clean renewable energy, ending homelessness, full employment, jobs for all, so forth and so on. But what I'm working on now are really two things. One is had a very successful few years of building a national coalition to fight voter suppression and voter purging, and I've been working with literally civil rights icons, and we're going to hold summits across the country, the first one being in Charlotte, where we're going to build a 21st century movement to crush voter purging. Over 17 million voters purged, most of them illegally and with malfeasance by Republicans and hardliners. Threatens our democracy. And the second thing is working on a similar coalition of coalitions to fight climate change. Over 11,000 scientists are saying that we're at the precipice of civilization-threatening climate change. So building a movement with enough power to beat the utility companies, get legislation passed in Congress, local, state, federal level, the United Nations. And I'm also a musician, so I'm recording my second CD.
Well, good for you. And Joel, and I'm going to take issue while I think of it here. I don't like to call it climate change. I think we should call it climate catastrophe or climate chaos. And it's really not global warming. It's a phrase that I love from Amory Lovins, global weirding. And, you know, I think that we've got to really be clear that this is not some kind of easy transition here into some other kind of, heated world. It's really just chaotic, catastrophic, and very weird transition into the apocalypse. So I'm a big advocate of not calling it climate change or global warming. I think those are too benign, and they give
it. You have converted me to not using the word climate change, but climate catastrophe and climate chaos. And having been to Puerto Rico right after the hurricane and drinking the water, I got sick and hospitalized. Bahamas, 1,000 people dead or missing. 150 bushfires in Australia. 44 million people facing starvation and drought in Africa. This was on CNN. And I really think the climate catastrophe movement is going to have to unify and get out of their silos. I'm going to be very frank here. There is a foundation industrial complex, which is, to me, having a very adverse impact on our movement. And, you know, there's going to have to be a unified front. You can't beat these utility companies. There are 200 of them, actually, that provide most of the power. But we're going to have to change the Congress, change the White House, and pass laws and just outlaw the use of fossil fuels. But we'll also want to do a war not only on climate chaos, but poverty, ending poverty here in America and around the world. People can call us dreamers, but, you know, I'd rather be a dreamer than an oppressor.
Well, there's no doubt that this has got to happen. And the other, and Howie, I'm sure you're going to jump in on this, in my mind, this vague talk about dealing with climate catastrophe, and maybe I'll turn this over to Howie to answer this one, but, I mean, we have a solution. And the solution is clearly to go to renewable energy. And so when people do all this vague talking about dealing with the climate crisis and then leaving it that, I think it's a digression. It diverts people. And we have a very, very specific agenda here to deal with saving our climate, and that is to go to solar, to wind, to battery storage, and to LED efficiency. Those four technologies, which have just, you know, exploded and haven't in many ways become the world's, I think they're the world's, combined, they are the world's fastest growing industries. You know, it's not just, oh, we're fighting climate, whatever. It's we're converting to a green economy, which, of course, is at the core of the Green Party. So, Howard, you want to speak to that?
Yeah, we call it the Green New Deal. I was the first candidate in the United States to campaign for a Green New Deal when I ran for governor in 2010 in New York. And it was about the energy transition, but it was also about getting out of the Great Recession. You know, I was running against Governor Cuomo, now Governor Cuomo, and he was running on austerity. In fact, he called himself the real Tea Party candidate. So we counterposed the Hawkins Prosperity Plan to the Cuomo Austerity Plan. And it was a massive investment in clean energy to get the economy going and to fight poverty, I mean, create jobs. I mean, this is something that the safe energy movement, going back to the anti-nuclear movement in the 70s, the Clamshell Alliance, we were saying this is a job creator. And, of course, the corporations say, no, you're gonna kill jobs, but that's just a big lie. So where we're at now is, it's too late to, you know, go with just regulations and standards and subsidies and incentives. The public sector's got to step in and do this and plan the transition so we can get to 100% clean energy not just in power production, but in the other sectors, manufacturing, agriculture, buildings, and transportation. And that means we got to do what we did during World War II when the federal government either built or took over a quarter of the manufacturing capacity of the country in order to build what they called the arsenal of democracy to fight the fascists. We need to do nothing less now. So that means public power in the energy sector. It means the National Railroad Corporation to electrify freight rails, bullet trains, rebuild the trolleys we had in this country, the light rails within our cities. We had them in our country between 1900 and 1930. It means manufacturing. We got to change the whole way we do things, from cement production, which accounts for about 5% of the world's carbon footprint because of the calcium carbonate, you know, it heats up and the carbon goes into the atmosphere, to, say, steel production instead of coke ovens, electric arc furnaces. And we're not going to do that by trying to incentivize corporate America, because they got their technology and they're going to want to wear it out before they switch to something else, like from a servo mechanical grid for centralized power plants to a digital smart grid for the distributed solar and wind energy. So that's the path we got to take. And, you know, we're happy that the Democrats have picked up the idea of a Green New Deal. What disappoints us is that they've taken the brand and diluted the content. So, for example, this non-binding resolution that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ed Markey put in drop the ban on fracking and new fossil fuel infrastructure, which we've got to have a ban on those things so we stop producing infrastructure that's going to burn fossil fuels for decades more. They dropped the phase out of nuclear power. They don't talk about cutting the military budget and putting that money into the Green New Deal. And they extended the deadline to try to do all this from 2030 to 2050. You don't give the politicians another 20 years because they're just going to wait. So, you know, that's why the Green Party's out here trying to advance this program. And, you know, talk about the urgency. You're right. This is not just, you know, more severe storms and more heat waves. It's an existential crisis. I mean, they're, you know, some of our best climate scientists are saying if we go to 4 degrees Celsius rise in temperature, 90% of humanity won't be able to survive by the end of the century. I mean, this is nothing like we've ever faced. And, you know, our concern is, Trump calls climate change a hoax, but the Democrats are acting as if it's a hoax. And we need much stronger medicine than we're getting right now.
And what are the impacts, Harry Hawkins, candidate for the nomination for the Green Party, what are the impacts of the conversion to what I call a solartopian economy in terms of the benefits to the economy and to the job situation in this country? Yeah, there are those who argue that converting to a solar topony economy will give us full employment. What do you think about that?
Well, we have costed out and have a sketched out a budget for what we call the eco-socialist Green New Deal. And I did this with an economist that used to work with Seymour Melman, who was the nation's foremost expert. He was an industrial engineer at Columbia University on peace conversion, converting the military-industrial complex to civilian production. And he was the guy I worked with, John Wren, was Seymour Melman's research assistant for 20 years. And we costed it out, and so we got the costs and the jobs created across all these sectors. And it's 38 million jobs. The bottleneck, the barrier in getting this transition done as fast as we need to is not the technology, we've got it. It's not the money, we got that. It's finding enough people to do the work. So the idea that, you know, this energy transition is not going to be a boom to the economy is nuts. It is. And, you know, the only question is if we can find enough people to do the work fast enough.
Fantastic. And how? What will it do to the economy in general? Give us a sketch of, you know, we're seeing a big test of this in Germany. I mean, Germany, which is not exactly a hippie commune, it's the fourth largest economy in the world, is making the transition. They've argued that, well, they're planning to shut, and I have not seen a reversal of this plan. They are planning to shut all their nuclear plants by 2022. With a massive push to renewable energy. How's that working out, Harry Hawkins?
Well, they're making progress. I'm concerned that they're still depending on natural gas as a so-called bridge fuel to 100% renewables. But, you know, the fact that they've been able to move off of nuclear power and coal and more into wind and solar is, you know, the way we need to go. In terms of what it
is, and climate scientists here and in Europe, that we're going to introduce in the United States Congress, and we're going to get passed. And I am the one who wrote the bill, Medicare for All, H.R. 676, Expanded and Improved Medicare for All. John Conyers was the first person who introduced that bill. I wrote it with 40 physicians. And because it was drafted with some of the best and brightest doctors and economists and organizations, it's now 2020. We introduced it in 2003. We built a movement around the bill, and that's why the Democratic Party, that's why Medicare for All is still being debated. Similarly, we're going to do a very similar process. But if you don't have legislation, you know, that explains exactly how to do this transition, what are the benefits, and what's the price tag, we're going to have a series of talks and symposiums and conferences. But I'll close by this. What did Martin Luther King do when he organized in the Civil Rights Movement and against the Vietnam War? It was passed in 1964 and 1965, Civil Rights Act, and get out of Vietnam. And this movement that we have is robust, but it's going to have to evolve now into unity and passing radical, deep systemic legislation. And that's not going to happen unless we're united and we're funded. But I'm so glad that your vision was what Mark Jacobson talks about, Al Gore, and so many others, but you really, really nailed it, man.
So we got three, and Joel, your Climate Coalition. Tell us about that, and tell us about how this vision, this solartopian vision, can fit in.
Well, Justice Action Mobilization Network was founded about 6 years ago at a conference of leading climate activists and social justice activists, mainly from communities of color. Then we had a follow-up convention at NYU that was, I think, historical. And basically, everyone who was there agreed that if we were going to fight and win the climate catastrophe battle and rapidly transition to 100% clean, renewable energy and create millions of green jobs and end homelessness with green, energy-efficient housing, we'd all have to work together. Because at the time, everyone really was siloed. And where Solartopia comes in is that's the basis of the Jammin' movement, is Solartopia. But do it as rapidly as possible. Mark Jacobson of Stanford says, you know, 80%, 100% clean renewable energy in 10 years. That's not, or we're facing, you know, civilization-threatening catastrophe. We're not talking about 2050 anymore, but Solartopia is the centerpiece of what we're trying to achieve. But we don't want to talk about it. We want to fight for and implement that plan, and it is going to be a war. And I'll close with this. In Charlotte, the former mayor, Jennifer Roberts, and all the different climate activists and civil rights groups formed a coalition. We got a plan passed to get us to 100% clean renewable energy by 2050, 80% by 2030, and housing and transportation. And the mayor goes in front of Congress and says, we don't have the money to buy electric buses from Proterra. And that's what we're going to hear all across the country from people who are doing fantastic local work. Well, we need a federal bill that would subsidize these local transitions and state transitions and pass laws we need to achieve Solartopia.
Fantastic. How's that? Do you know about this climate change coalition that Joel Siegel is involved in?
Yeah, I've heard of it. I've been mostly involved in, you know, local fights, like we got a ban on fracking in New York. And, you know, that is something that I campaigned for in 2010 at a time when most of the environmental movement was saying natural gas is a bridge to the renewable future, or let's have a moratorium while we study the water impact. And we were saying it's a climate bomb. We got to stop it now. And the movement switched, and by 2014, I got 5% of the vote for governor, and Governor Cuomo wanted to, you know, get a bigger vote than his father ever got, more than he got in 2010, and he got less. And he saw the Greens over here with 5% of the vote, and he responded to what we said. He just had to compete for what we were saying. We were saying a ban on fracking. We also got a $15 minimum wage and paid family leave and a gesture, at least, toward free public college education. And so, you know, that's, you know, where I've been at. I mean, I'm up on a national level now because they asked me to run for president. So I haven't been involved in these national coalitions from Syracuse. I've been really fighting in the trenches. So, you know, I'm aware of what they're doing, and, you know, I appreciate what they're doing.
Well, I got to raise with you now a really, it's not a pet peeve, it's way beyond that. One of the things that Cuomo did, and Howie, you're well aware of this, and I need you to speak to it, is that he bailed out the four, well, he didn't bail out, he forced the state, the ratepayers of the state, to bail out those four Chernobyl-in-progress nuclear plants in upstate New York. You want to talk about what he did here? I mean, I can barely contain myself when this comes up.
Yeah, he made New York the first of several states now that are subsidizing nuclear power plants that the owners wanted to shut down because they weren't making money. I mean, nuclear power is not just an environmental disaster. It's been one of the worst industrial industries, you know, in terms of its economic impact ever. And he made it part of our quote-unquote clean energy portfolio. And now we have the Democratic governor of Pennsylvania and his plan, subsidizing nuclear power plants to supposedly create more nuclear carbon-free power. And, you know, they just got the bill passed in Ohio to subsidize, you know, the Bessie Davis and Perry plants. And, you know, that was more to Republicans, although a third of the Democrats in both the House and the Senate voted for the subsidy. So, you know, this is a big problem because nuclear power is such a diversion from the energy transition we need to make. You know, the idea that you can build nukes because they're carbon-free, with that same money, you can build a lot more energy, you know, production through solar and wind. And it takes too long to build them. There are always cost overruns. There were subsidies for the nukes down in South Carolina and Georgia. And I think there was six or eight they planned. There's only one left they're building because the others, just the cost overruns were too much of a problem. So, you know, that is a dead end. And, you know, it's too bad that New York led the way in this, you know, movement down that dead end. But it's a
big problem. Motivated
wrong direction.
I don't live in New York. I really don't like either the governor Andrew Cuomo or the guy that Cuomo Chris, who's on TV. I mean, whenever Chris Cuomo comes on CNN, I turn away. I mean, I think I'm not going to go into it. I just can't stand to look at him. And part of it is because what his brother has done here. What was Andrew Cuomo's motivation for bailing out these nuclear plants? Why did he do it?
Well, he had to do something on, you know, carbon reduction because there's a lot of pressure for that. We have a real movement in New York State. And so he just decided nuclear power was going to be included in that. I think that's part of it. I think part of it is the nuclear industry. They're big campaign contributors. I mean, Exelon owns several of the nukes that are being subsidized. And, you know, they've had their ties to the Democratic Party. David Axelrod was one of their PR flacks before he got involved in the Obama campaign as I guess his, you know, I forget his title, but he helped form Obama's message. And then, of course, Obama was, you know, seeking subsidies for more nuclear power plants. So I think it's, you know, it's the corporate influence on the Democratic Party. And Cuomo is a corporate politician if there ever was one. I mean, I ran against him in 2018. He had $100 million from, you know, the utility industry and the nuclear industry, but also, you know, big finance and the real estate barons. So I think it's, you know, these politicians answer to their donors more than their voters.
Well, I got to throw in here, first of all, of course, I've been involved with the nuclear issue since 1973. And, you know, nuclear power is not carbon free. I mean, I can't even begin to tell you how furious it makes me to hear that argument. All nuclear plants emit carbon 14, which is radioactive. And, of course, massive amounts of carbon are used to not only build the plants and not only decommission the plants, but also to create the fuel that has to go into the reactor cores. And then what happened here in Ohio, and you, Howie, you need to be aware of this when you're campaigning, is that you're right, the Democrats in the Ohio legislature, and the Ohio legislature is completely gerrymandered. I mean, it's beyond, you know, Ohio is more or less 50-50 Republican and Democrat, and yet the Republicans have super majorities in both houses of the Ohio legislature. It's insane, and they are the worst kind of Republicans. They're just corrupt, brain dead. I mean, you go into the Ohio legislature, it's like the night of the living dead in there, you know. It's like they've required everybody that who joins the Ohio legislature to have a lobotomy. And these people are just terrible. And so Perry and Davis, Bessie Glantz, were about to shut because they are huge money losers. And First Energy, which is really a mob operation, got this incredibly corrupt legislature to hand them a $1 billion handout, bailout, at ratepayer expense. And the ratepayers in Ohio, as in New York, by the way, who don't get electricity in the southern part of the state, who don't get electricity from Perry and Davis Bessie, still had their rates raised to bail out these two nuclear plants. And it's vastly unpopular in Ohio. Every poll, even the media, the newspapers in Ohio, which are incredibly corporate and right-wing, they very strongly have been editorializing against this bailout. And so the oil and gas industry, when this bailout passed, and this tremendous controversy, jumped in, and they sponsored the gathering of signatures for a referendum to repeal this bailout, which everybody in Ohio knows, if it got on the ballot, would pass overwhelmingly. And so they drafted a referendum. It went to the Ohio, I can't remember if it's the Attorney General or the Secretary of State, and that guy, a Republican, sat on it for as long as he possibly could. There's a 20-day maximum. He sat on it for 19 days. And then they sent it back and said, no, it's no good. Can't go on the ballot. So the people, it was called Ohioans Against Corporate Bailouts, rewrote it, sent it back to him. He sat on it for another 19 days, and they said, okay, you can do it. Now, the statute, you know, the referendum statute was written a century ago during the progressive movement. And there were no restrictions on it. You put in a referendum, it went on the ballot, that was it. But, you know, along the way, the legislature put all these caveats. And so 38 days passed by out of the 90-day deadline to bring in half a million signatures to get something on the ballot. So from 90 days, it went to 52 days. And then, and this is what's killer, the oil and gas industry, the opponents of the nuclear bailout, put people in the field to gather signatures. And the nuclear industry hired what they called blockers. And these are basically stormtroopers. These are thugs. These are guys right out of the Gestapo. And they did stuff like, if a signature gatherer, and these were people who were paid, they came in, a lot of them came in from out of state, but people were gathering signatures to put this perfectly legitimate referendum on the ballot. And they would be surrounded by three blockers who would physically intimidate both them and people wanting to sign the petition. I mean, this is total fascism. And I have not heard of this before. This is a violent terrorist operation designed to intimidate people from signing a perfectly legitimate petition for a referendum. And as a result of the days getting cut from 90 to 52, and B, these fascist thugs, people did not get sufficient signatures to put the repeal of the bailout on the ballot. And the Supreme Court got complicated. The referendum supporters went to federal court. The federal court judge turned it over to the Ohio Supreme Court. The Ohio Supreme Court sat on it and has continued to sit on it until finally last week the opponents of the bailout threw in the towel. Now that is the state of our democracy in this country. And that is completely... That's fascism, pure and simple. And as a result, these two nuclear plants, which, I mean, I could do 2 hours on how bad these reactors are. Perry is the first reactor in the United States to be damaged, physically damaged, by an earthquake. And I grew up in Columbus. I never heard of earthquakes in Ohio, but they managed to find a place to build a nuclear plant that could be damaged by an earthquake in Ohio. It was in January of 1986. And Davis-Vesey is known worldwide as probably the most dangerous reactor in the world. I mean, its litany of disaster is astounding. And I know for a fact that the reactors in upstate New York are pretty bad. I mean, those plants are really old. And, of course, the owners of these reactors are not financially liable. When the next one blows up, the owner's just going to walk away. So, Howie, you know, when you're out campaigning, you know, this is a big deal, and we're going to rely on you to spread the word on this. Do you want to jump in and say anything on this, you and then Joel, and then we'll move on to a couple other issues?
Well, in terms of suppressing signature gatherers, unfortunately, the Green Party's experienced that. Probably the worst period was 2004. I mean, physically, people were hired to physically obstruct petition gatherers for Ralph Nader in 2004. So we've seen that before. And, you know, the big irony here is that the owners of these nukes were ready to shut them down, and instead the ratepayers are bailing them out. You know, the thing about, you know, what happened to Nader, and it's happened not quite, you know, three thugs sitting around a gatherer, but harassment and smearing and so forth to Green Party gatherers, is that, you know, Joe brought up voter suppression. I would argue that part of voter suppression in this country is party suppression. This country is off the charts difficult compared to every other electoral democracy in the world on the number of signatures you got to get and the time frame you got to get them to get a third party on the ballot. And, of course, a lot of people don't vote because they don't like the two major parties. The other aspect of that is winner-take-all elections instead of proportional representation for legislatures and ranked choice voting for executive offices. And people feel like, well, my candidate can't win, so I'm not even going to vote. Because of the gerrymandering, most districts for legislature are one-party districts because they're overwhelmingly Democratic or Republican. So a lot of people don't vote because they say, why bother? We already know who's going to win. So there's a lot of angles to the voter suppression thing. And I guess I'll add just one more point is, you know, the Greens are often scapegoated for losses, you know, like Trump winning in 2016. But a much bigger, much, much bigger factor was the suppression of voters, particularly black voters. So I'm glad Joe's working on that issue because it's a huge problem. We have a lot of flaws and shortcomings in our electoral democracy.
Joel Siegel, you want to comment on that?
Well, Howie, thank you for your appreciation of the work on voter suppression. And actually, in 2004, when I was working with Congressman Conyers, and I got a call from the late Tim Carpenter of Progressive Democrats of America, Jesse Jackson, telling me that tens of thousands of votes in Ohio were, you know, thrown away, right, through voter suppression. And I never heard of voter suppression. And I told Jesse Jackson to call Mr. Conyers, who is my brother, who I love dearly, who just passed away recently at the age of 90. I said, let's hold a hearing. Let's hold a hearing in Congress, one in the Congress and one in Ohio, and let's show the world what's happening with voter suppression in this country. And, you know, it's now 2020, right? Almost 15, 16 years later, and voter suppression is so much worse between over 17 million people who've been purged illegally off the voting rolls, mostly Hispanics, blacks, Asian, Pacific Americans, and young people, through what's called a cross check, where they say, oh, we have a Harvey Farnback in Washington, D.C., or Harvey Wasserman in California, but then there's two names, they have similar names in Alabama, we're going to cross check them and throw them off the voting rolls. And now you've got a right wing organization as powerful as the Heritage Foundation suing secretaries of states. It's saying that in order to keep the voting list current, you're going to have to purge the voting rolls. Now, if that's not fascism and authoritarianism, I don't know what is. And the reason why we're having our first national summit with Rainbow Coalition and Transformative Justice Coalition, several other organizations, we're doing one here, one in Los Angeles, probably maybe in six or seven other cities or towns. And if anybody's interested in doing a voter suppression summit, I'll give you my number in a second, but if we do not...
We're going to do one in Los Angeles in June or July, so
Well, thank God, Harvey. But what I wanted to tell all of our listeners, Harvey Wasserman was one of the single most important advocates in 204 at that time. I believe you testified in Congress and then wrote a book, What Went Wrong in Ohio. You're one of our founding fathers, so to speak, of the anti-voter suppression movement. And the next election, and who's in the White House, and if whether we're going to have McConnell in the Senate with the gavel or Trump, will depend on voter suppression. And I'll close by saying that the reason why Stacey Abrams lost in Georgia is because of voter suppression. And you know, America's got to wake up. We have fallen asleep as, you know, we've moved closer and closer to Mussolini's fascism. And I don't get mad. I just organize, you know.
Well, I get mad. I was living in Ohio in 2004, where I am right now. And, you know, I'm a historian, and I wouldn't have known anything that was going on. But Bob Patrakis, my buddy, is a political scientist. And he was calling me up and saying, hey, they're doing this, this, and that. And I would type up the articles, and then we'd put them out on the Internet. And so and thank God Bob had a website, freepress.org. And so we broke, through Bob's research, the major stories in 2004 that pointed out that I wrote a digest of more than 100 different ways that the Republicans stole the election in 2004. I mean, John Kerry was the legitimate winner, and had he carried Ohio in 2004 in the Electoral College, he would have unseated George W. Bush. And we thoroughly briefed Kerry's people. Couldn't get a rise out of him, although his running mate, John Edwards, was roundly pissed and told Kerry not to concede, which Kerry did at 1 o'clock the next day, and then went windsurfing. And I was at, Bob and I were at the hearings that you helped set up in Washington, and I sat next to Bernie Sanders, and Nadler was there, who's now, you know, one of the part of the impeachment team. And what have the Democrats done about voter suppression? Nothing. You know, Al Gore and John Kerry never raised the issue of the Electoral College and have done zero to deal with the flipping of electronic voting machines, which we saw in Florida 2000 and in Ohio 2004 and all over in 2016, or the stripping of the voter. It's outrageous. Now, Howie, I want to bring this up. You know, we only got less than 20 minutes left. The Green Party, we just saw an editorial at Truth Dig, begging people to not support the Green Party in 2020 for fear of throwing the election to the Republicans. And in the course of this article, and this is, you know, real heavy hitters on the left, and of course a beautifully written piece, they raised the issue, the idea that if you took Jill Stein's votes in 2016 from Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, and gave them all to Hillary, Hillary would have won. What do you want to say about that?
Well, I wrote a response. TruthDig hasn't published it. The LA Progressive did, and ZNet did, because Michael Albert, I think, was the principal author of that open letter. And I titled it, Every State is a Battleground, because for the Green Party, every state is a battleground. We're fighting for our very right to be on the ballot. We're fighting for election integrity. You mentioned 2004. It was the Green Party with the Libertarian Party, not the Kerry campaign, that called for a recount to expose all these shenanigans that went on in Ohio. Same thing happened in 2016. The Clinton people turned down these lawyers. They went to Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, and she went ahead to force a recount, which exposed a lot of problems. And both of those efforts led to things like in 2004, the Conyers report that we've talked about voter suppression and voting, machine irregularities and so forth, and, to reforms in states in terms of getting more verifiable processes. So, that's one reason why the Green Party needs to be out there. And, take a battleground state like Ohio. You know, the Democratic Party is totally for fracking. You know, who's going to be against fracking? And then the idea that, say, I'm the candidate and I go to Ohio and say, here's why we need a Green New Deal, and it's better than what the Democrats are offering. And we need, I mean, H.R. 676 is better than the bill Sanders has now in terms of a single-payer insurance system. You know, I like the old Dellums bill, a national health service where you have more democratic accountability and better cost control. It's another form of single-payer. So, you know, I make the case for those things. Or the thing that nobody's talking about is this nuclear modernization and new nuclear arms race. And that's why the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists just moved the needle to 100 seconds before midnight on their doomsday clock, which is the closest it's ever been. And that's not being talked about. So, you know, I go to Ohio and I campaign. I have a campaign event and I tell people this is our platform. And then, you know, these people that wrote that letter then want me to say, but don't vote for me, vote for the Democrats. I mean, that's crazy. And it's such inside baseball. Most voters vote for what they want. They want to make a statement for their vote. You know, a Democrat in a majority Republican district who goes to vote and isn't totally alienated, they'll vote for the Democrat, even though they know their Democrat won't win, because they want to make a statement in support of the Democrats as opposed to the Republicans. And if you're if you vote for the Democratic presidential candidate, you know, that vote gets lost. Even if you're a Sanders socialist, you can't tell the difference between that and a Biden or Clinton corporatist. A green vote, everybody knows what that means. And so, you know, what we're trying to do is build an independent movement and party for equal socialism, because we need fundamental change, real solutions to these life or death issues. So, you know, I wrote that in my response, and some of the people that published the letter from, you know, Albert and Chomsky and the rest of them have not published it. But this is a debate we've had since 2004. In fact, I put together a book based on the back and forth then over this so-called safe state strategy. It's called Independent Politics, the Green Party Strategy Debate. It came out in 2006. And people can read the whole argument, which back then wasn't much different from what we're talking about today. So, you know, those were some of my responses. And, you know, as a practical matter, we're petitioning to get on the ballot now. And it's not clear what the battleground states are. I mean, is Georgia a battleground state? Well, after that Kemp-Abrams race, it looks like it is, whereas before it was a safe state. I think there are a lot more battleground states. You know, the letter said there's probably 10. Well, most analysts are saying at least 15. And, of course, it changes as the polls go up and down. It's, you know, in terms of practically implementing it, if I campaigned for the Green Party nomination saying I'm going to run a safe state strategy, every state that is a battleground, their delegates are going to say, we don't want you for a candidate because you won't campaign for us. And we got real issues with the Democrats in our state, whether it's public school privatization or energy policy or the fact that, you know, both parties, with the exception of a few Democrats, were for this coup in Venezuela. So, you know, we're out there building a movement, putting our platform forward, and, you know, really what we want to do is get ballot lines out of this election, because the presidential vote affects whether you get to keep your ballot line after you petition to get on, and use that to elect thousands of people to local and county office, municipal and county, and then eventually state and Congress, and build a new major party from the bottom up. So that's what the campaign's about. And, you know, to stand down in a battleground state, I mean, it may be a battleground between Trump and whoever the Democrat is, but for the Greens, it's a battleground just to get on the ballot. Here in New York, the Democrats, led by Governor Cuomo, just increased by 2.5 times the number of votes you need to get to stay on the ballot and tripled the number of signatures you need to get, which makes New York now one of the hardest states in the country to have for a third party to get on the ballot. That's the Democrats, you know, and we're supposed to just say, okay, we'll support you because Trump is so bad. The Democrats are bad, too.
Unbelievable. I know you're not a psychiatrist, Howie, but I got to ask you this question because I'm sure it's come up. Why, when Jill Stein, who I think is terrific, and I'm going to be having her on a future show, I've known Jill for a long time. She ran two great campaigns at great personal cost. But she went in with Bob Fitrakis, my co-conspirator, to Michigan, and pointed out to a judge that there were 70,000 beheaded ballots, people who ballots were counted in that had no preference for president. We're supposed to believe the people in primarily Detroit and Flint stood in line for hour after hour, cast a ballot, but did not vote for president. 70,000 of them. Now, we saw ballots like this in New Mexico in at the Indian reservations in 2004. So we're asked to believe that people stood in line and refrained from voting for president, even though the rest of the ballots were filled out. So Jill Stein went to court with Bob She raised $7 million on the internet, not from the Democratic Party, to look at the key swing states. Wisconsin, we discovered that, or Bob did, that they were using uncertified software. Michigan, we found this. Pennsylvania, which had a Democratic governor, Jill couldn't get the time of day. But in Michigan, a judge with Hillary Clinton's lawyers in the courtroom said that, yes, there should be a recount, but it requires by law that those requesting the recount have a chance, a mathematical chance to win. And so that was the time when Hillary should have stood up or was expected to stand up and say, yeah, we'll support the recount. Go ahead. And they didn't. They turned it down. Hillary's lawyers in the courtroom told the judge that we can't support this. We're just here to observe, and no recount happened in Michigan, for God's sakes, which Trump allegedly carried by 10,000 votes. Can you tell me, Howie Hawkins, do you have any idea why Clinton refused to support the Green Party successful request for a recount in Michigan in 2016?
Well, I can't get in their heads. I think politically they are more concerned with the stability of this country from the point of view of the ruling class, the big corporate elites, than they are for election results. I mean, this goes back to 2000 in the Florida recount. You know, Jesse Jackson, among others, were mobilizing people to demonstrate for a full recount, and, you know, Gore and Lieberman told them, don't do that. Meanwhile, they had the Brooks Brothers riots. All the Republican operatives and, you know, congressional staffers were down there pounding on the windows while people were trying to recount the ballots. And in the end, of course, the Republican majority on the Supreme Court stopped the recount and anointed Bush. And then we know a media consortium of, you know, major media organizations went back and did a recount, and actually Gore won statewide. So the Democrats don't even seem to want to fight for their own votes. And, you know, that's another reason why, you know, the Greens feel we cannot rely on the Democrats to fight the right, the Trump right, the Republican right, because, you know, when the doors are closed and they get down to business, I mean, the Democrats have been normalizing Trump. They tout NAFTA 2.0, the U.S.-Canada-Mexico trade agreement just got passed. They vote for increases in the military budget overwhelmingly in Congress. There's an infrastructure bill out today which, from the point of view of energy transition, that, you know, both parties say they're going to work on together, it's not what we need in terms of the new infrastructure for the energy transition. So, you know, the Greens feel like we are better off as progressives, independent on the left, speaking and acting and voting for ourselves rather than, you know, surrendering to the lesser evil, which really won't fight the greater evil that hard. I mean, the classic case is Germany. You know, the Social Democrats said, we're going to support the conservative Hindenburg to defeat Hitler. And Hindenburg won, and he appointed Hitler chancellor. You can't rely on the establishment center to fight the far right. We got to fight them ourselves.
Joe Siegel, you want to jump in on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think one question that I want to ask Brother Howie is, if Sanders wins the nominations, and or Elizabeth Warren, and many of their positions are truly reflective of Green Democratic positions, would the Green Party and you support their campaign so that they could actually win the nomination, and who do you think should be their vice presidential candidate? That's number one. Number two is, I'm going to begin to start being a whistleblower and about the U.S. Congress, because I worked there for 13 years, and I had the freedom to do that. 80% of the... I want all your listeners to really hear this. 70 to 80% of the time that I spent on the Hill, what I saw happening were, and many of these members of Congress, these were some of them very progressive, they were raising money. That's what they did. They raised money for TV commercials, for their next campaigns. And one thing that we're going to have to get back to talking about is publicly financed campaigns. And there used to be a real big movement like Citizen Action and others. I don't know what happened to that. But we need publicly financed campaigns, because what's happening is most policies that you see coming out of the Congress are being drafted by young kids in their early 20s. Many of them did not have the training or the experience or even the knowledge to really craft a good bill. And while the members are out there raising the money, a bunch of little kids, some of them very, you know, of course, well-intended, are running this country. I don't think it's a good idea for kids who just came out of college without real experience working in inner cities or working with people in jail or working with foster care system kids or just to run the country. But I wanted to ask Howie about, would he support the, you know, the progressive Democrats, and what about campaign finance reform? Sorry about that, Howie. It's kind of a long question.
Well, I think on the policies, I mean, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez...
Wait, Howie, let me interrupt you real quick. We're going to be run out of time, and I won't let you go ahead, but how do people get a hold of you, and how do they come to support your campaign and the Green Party?
Go to the website, HowieHawkins.us, and you can volunteer, donate, read what we're talking about. It's HowieHawkins.us. And look, we are, as Greens, open to working with progressive Democrats on the issues. In fact, we do. We just wish it would be more of a two-way street. You know, we're happy they took the Green New Deal, but they never, you know, come to us, you know, to be on the platform with them. You know, Jill Stein, after Bernie was, you know, denied the nomination through some shenanigans in 2016, said, you know, let's talk, let's see how we might could work together. Bernie never got back to her. You know, I'm rooting for Bernie, personally. I've known him since 1972 when he was running in Vermont, and I dropped leaflets for him. I set up slideshows, his Eugene Debs slideshow he did later in the 70s. He will move the debate to the left. And if he does win the nomination and wins the presidency, I think he'll cream Trump in a landslide because he'll take votes from the green left, and he'll take more votes from people that flipped from Obama to Trump because they were disgusted with, you know, what the Democrats represented in terms of their downward mobility. So I think Bernie will win. But the first people he'll be fighting if he gets elected are those conservative centrist Democrats in Congress who don't believe in single-payer health care. Pelosi calls the Green New Deal the Green Dream, and she won't let them even vote on the watered-down, non-binding resolution in Congress. So I'm all for working together. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez blurted out the other day that in any other country, which would have proportional representation, she and Joe Biden would be in different parties. And I think in the long run, the Greens and the progressive Democrats need to be in the same party, and it would be a major party. The majority of people would support our platform. And I think that's where we got to get to. So, you know, this open letter, going back to that, you know, why are they picking on the Greens? I mean, there are bigger factors like voter suppression. And we just had, you know, Clinton out there calling Jill Stein a Russian asset and saying the Russians and Republicans are grooming a third-party candidate. You know, the Greens feel under attack. And even though, you know, these progressives said, you know, made their states safe state strategy, the reaction of Greens is like, why are these people picking on us too? We should be working together.
Yes. Siegel, want to tell people, respond and tell people how to get a hold of you?
Yeah, Joel, Joel.R, as in Ross, Siegel, S-E-G-A-L, at gmail.com.
All right, so I was stunned when I read the that open letter. I mean, it came from very respected people on the left, and, you know, having seen elections stolen now since 2004, but being, you know, knowing very well Greg Powell's work about 2000, I can't imagine why people aren't focused on election theft. I mean, that's okay. That's where it's really at. Listen, you guys, you've been tremendous guests. It's been a great show. Have you back on, Howie. Good luck with your campaign. Joel, I'll be on the conference call with you about climate catastrophe, global weirding. This has been a great hour. As are they all in the Saratoga Green Power and Wellness Show. Thanks to the crew in New York. And we'll see you next week in Saratopia.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Saratopia?
We bit the apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but
oh, yeah. Don't you know?